welcome to Open Paddock Podcast, episode number 170. This is the first episode of the 2013 season. It is Tuesday, January 8th. I am your host, Kevin Neely, and I am joined tonight by the one like Mike Shaw. Say hello, Mike.
Hello, everybody.
And the one, J. Douglas Patterson, Esquire.
Hello.
And we're going to pour one out for our homie, Mr. Weitzel, right now, who is not with us tonight, a victim of the flu epidemic of Superstorm nastiness 2013 edition or whatever they're calling it.
I think he gave it to me via email.
Talk about your internet viruses.
Yeah, exactly.
I wish I had a rim shot sound effect right now.
So anyway, I will apologize if you hear some sniffles and some coughs. I will try to keep my finger close to the mute button. But in case I'm slow, my apologies.
Yeah, Doug's got a nice little case of Ebola going on over there. So yeah.
I'm trying to blame everybody I can.
We'll pray for you, little buddy. Hope you get feeling better soon. All right. There's one thing we have to start out with, gentlemen. What are tonight's drink selections?
Well, I guess I'll start out. I'm having actually something that I had a couple of times ago, the India Pale Ale called Hop Czar from, again, local brewery Bridgeport. It's good stuff.
I am having a classic Tanqueray martini. I'm hoping that this will be like Germex for my insides.
Nice and done.
If nothing else, it'll be piney fresh, correct?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Hopefully I make it strong enough, it'll clear out my sinuses.
And tonight my selection is, I'm straying from my usual Bushmills tonight, gentlemen.
Oh, yes.
Tonight we have the Abita Turbo Dog from Abita Brewing in Louisiana.
Oh, is it good?
Do you like dark beer, sir?
I do. My motto on beer is, if I can read a newspaper through it, it is not beer.
I'm with Doug on that one.
That is definitely my philosophy as well. Now, I almost wanted to consider this a porter because it's black when you pour this beer.
Does it look like used motor oil?
Yes, it does.
Proper. Okay. That's a proper beer.
Reading from the back, it says, Turbo Dog is a dark brown ale brewed with pale caramel and chocolate malts and Willamette hops. This combination gives Turbo Dog its rich body and color and a sweet chocolate toffee-like flavor.
That would be Willamette hops from my neck of the woods, just to correct you a little there.
Okay, since I'm not Sean and I can't fire you, I'm putting you on unpaid leave. Whatever, kid. So, we got a lot of great stuff to share with you in this first episode of 2013. And unless one of you gentlemen has intermediate business to discuss, like, I don't know, AMA Supercross kicking off in Anaheim with David Millsaps taking the win and Trey Kennard coming back from an incredible crash the previous season to take second, and Ryan Villopoto having quite possibly the worst ever outing ever.
Oh, really?
Oh, my goodness.
I like Villopoto.
Oh, I love Villopoto, but the problem was is he got caught up in a crash at the start of the race, and then he kept having mechanicals, and I want to say he actually finished pretty close to dead last.
That sucks. Where did Chad Reed finish?
Chad Reed finished in fourth.
Okay, off the podium. I'm happy with that.
Chad Reed was fourth. Justin Barcia, in his Supercross debut, finished seventh. And that kid is amazing, by the way. Bubba Stewart finished eighth.
Oh, he's doing a 2013. You know, it kind of felt like he was going to just pass. He was, like, burnt out on racing.
Yeah, Bubba actually hurt his knee in qualifying, too.
Oh.
And that came up, well, I mean, there's a shock. Bubba Stewart getting hurt.
Yeah, no kidding. He made it last.
Villopoto finished 16th of 20, by the way. And okay. There was a big name finished 20th, actually. It was Mike Alessi.
Well, I don't have any moto news, but I do have some good news for our listeners. make sure you listen all the way to the end of the podcast, because at the end I'm going to tell you how you can win for yourself some fantastic swag that Mazda Speed Motorsports sent us. They got a hold of us and asked if we'd be happy to give away some calendars, and I said, yes, of course. And so I expected when a package came that there'd be a whole sheaf of 2013 Mazda calendars, and we do have some. And I tell you what, the photos here are really fantastic of the Mazda racing in MX-5 Cup, the Continental Tire Series, Grand Am, Pirelli World Challenge, Star Mazda, USF 2000, you know, all the various. Well, in fact, here's a I just turned to July, and this warms my heart. There's someone in a Miata in the DP class doing solo racing. So they've got it all. SCCA Solo Nationals, D Prepared, Mazda Miata up in Lincoln, Nebraska. I'm really hoping to go to the Nationals this year. Anyway, anything that Mazda races in, they've got it. And it's just beautiful photography. I really think you'll like these calendars. So we've got those. We've also got the 2012 National Speedway Directory for the United States and Canada. Oval tracks, drag strips, road courses, sanctions, publications, museums, and, well, the 2012 race schedule you don't need anymore, but still a great, great reference source for all the various speedways and racetracks in North America. We also have a book, Performance Thinking, Mental Skills for the Competitive World, with a foreword by Patrick Dempsey. So, you know, kind of how to mentally prepare yourself, not just for racing, but for life in general. And then Think Fast, The Racer's Y2 Guide to Winning by Neil Roberts. So it kind of, if you're getting into racing, even if you're just doing some solo racing like I've been doing, this can really help you out. A little bit on suspension tuning, lines through corners and whatnot. But the thing that I'm really looking forward to giving away, well, okay, I'm not looking forward to giving this away. I really, really
can
want
I claim
to keep
dibs on that?
If dibs could be claimed, they already would have been. This is a fantastic book. This is Mazda's Conquest of Le Mans, Never Stop Challenging, by Pierre Dieudonné. Dieudonné? With the little accent on that. Someone else who's better with the French language may be able to help me out. But anyway, it's a large coffee table book, shrink wrapped, so I haven't taken a peek inside. But I'm sure if the cover art is anything to judge by, again, the photography in here will be just magnificent. A fantastic book for any motorsports fan, whether you're a fan of Mazda or not. It's still a fantastic motorsports piece of memorabilia and beautiful photography of beautiful race cars. What more can you want? So we'll have info on how you can win. Starting off, we'll start off with a 2013 Mazda calendar from Mazda Speed Motorsport. I'll tell you how you can win that here at the end of the podcast. And that was all that I had for now. Awkward pause.
Meh. So, Mike, you got anything over there, buddy?
I don't have anything particularly unique right now until we get down to Rally. There's a great event this last weekend that I can't wait to talk about.
Excellent, excellent. Well, being the resident Grand Am fan around here, and I mean probably the only Grand Am fan around here, let's talk a little sports car, because probably one of the bigger news stories of the weekend was the roar before the 24 going on down in Daytona. And along with that, we had some announcements by Grand Am and ALMS, including they have announced the class structure for the Unified Series in 2014.
You know, I'm glad they came out with this early. If they had done it on a Terry Engstead type of time scale, they would say, yeah, it'll be out in January, and July we're still waiting for the new structure. So I'm glad to see them have this hashed out very, very early to give teams and manufacturers time to get ready and make plans for 2014.
Yeah, and just to kind of go through a little bit of the homologation a bit, first off, the ALMS PT1 category is gone.
Well, not, it was kind of gone anyway.
You know, yeah, I was about to say, not that that's a big loss. So what they're going to do is combine P2 with Daytona prototypes.
Huh.
And then, yeah. And then run separate legacy series of the GT classes. They're going to have the ALMS GT class and then the Grand-Am GT class as separate series. And then the Continental Tire series is going to be administered completely separate, if I remember correctly.
Interesting. So what about, I know one of the big things that when I was listening to or reading articles and stuff about it was there's a lot of contention about whether or not this new combined thing, we're going to have cars that were eligible for the actual 24 hours of Le Mans.
Yeah, the P2 class, the P1 and P2 class, I know, are eligible for the 24 hours, and so are the ALMS GT cars. So I'm thinking that there is going to be some sort of homologation of the rules between the classes. Delta Wing is definitely also included in this series as well. So
great to see. You know,
yeah.
I just have to jump in. Man, talk about innovation. I mean, that's one thing that racing used to be about, and I think the Delta Wing really brings, even though it is kind of odd looking, yeah, okay, you can think of stuff that we've seen on SNL that resembles this car, but from an engineering standpoint, gosh, I'm so excited to see that out there and competing. I mean, I think it just opens up the mind to new possibilities versus all the spec racing we've seen over the years.
You know, I've said this before. I'm very happy that Delta Wing was not selected as the IndyCar platform, and I still feel that way. However, I think prototype sports car racing is the perfect place for this machine, and I'm very happy to see it have a formal place in the 2014 Grand Le Mans America GT prototype, yay, whatever. have they settled on a name, or are they just going to go with Grand Am? Is this going to be an absorption?
I think it's going to be the American Sport, the American Sanctified Sports Car Association of Racing, or something along those lines.
Okay.
Yeah.
It'll go under a new name then.
That's the word I've heard, is that they are going to come up with a new name for the combined series. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to hear something along the lines of, like, Grand American Le Mans series or something like that, where they just kind of do a Franken name of the series. They're having an alleged contest right now to select the new name of the series. So you could you can go to grandam.com, that's grand-am.com, and see the information for pulling up the contest. One thing that I've been really interested in is how are they going to handle combining the DPs and the LMP2s?
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. What's the equivalency going to be? You know, because it can't just be, well, we'll put a restrictor plate on one or the other, because the two platforms are based on such different philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know that just a straight equivalency, engine equivalency, will get the job done.
No, because as we've discussed before, you know, the LMP2 is a monocoque chassis, and the DP is a tube frame.
Right, and the handling characteristics are just so, so different. I mean, I guess you could do some testing around some of the, a couple of the standard tracks and try to equivalent average lap times, and I'd be all right with that, so that one frame would have an advantage on a certain section of the track, and the other frame might have an advantage on a different different sector or something like that, I'd be okay with that. But it'll be interesting to see how it is. It's not going to be easy, and it won't be simple.
And, you know, I'm probably going to get raked over the coals for saying this, but I hope that the solution is, first off, bigger engine for the DPs. Because the DP is a slower car than the LMP2. And then I hope that the solution beyond that is make everything a tube frame chassis.
Okay, yes, I've got the coals on in the chimney and starting up right now. I would much rather see the DPs go to a monocoque. Instead of a larger engine, I would rather see them go to a more sophisticated engine. I know costs and all that kind of stuff. However, what you have to understand about especially prototype sports car racing is you've got to give the manufacturers the opportunity to demonstrate their skills, to pimp their stuff, basically. I mean, look what Audi and Peugeot and now Toyota have been doing in the LMP1 class. And the fantastic engine technology that they've been bringing to the track. I think that's where we really need to go, as opposed to, and this isn't going to happen, because, of course, NASCAR and this new blendified sports car series, whatever they end up calling it, is a NASCAR product. And so I think they probably will stick with the stock block engine that they use in the DPs. That is what they use, and then it's basically a stock block V8.
Something along those lines. You can use a V8 or a V6, depending on how your engine is set up.
But they're all normally aspirated, right?
I want to say yes.
Yeah, I think we need some variation there. I mean,
yep.
Yeah, that's what brings the innovation, like you're saying, the amazing stuff that Toyota and Audi have done over the years. I mean, I think that's what's great for the sports car racing in general is opening up the doors for innovation like that. Sure, you have to have some restrictions, but I mean, you got to give them and you got to give it something so the classes can compete like that. You know, like you're saying that the would you say the LMP2s were a little too slow compared to the
DPs are slow compared to the LMP2s.
So why don't give them you know, there's what, three typical things you need, right? It's either more aero, give them a little bit more performance on the engine, or give them better tires.
You can also look at weight and ballast. And the reason why I say a monocoque as opposed to the tube frame, because the number one thing that a monocoque is going to be able to do for you, one, it's going to lighten the car. It will lighten the car while at the same time maintaining the safety of the cockpit. And it'll also make the car stiffer and more responsive to the wheel.
Well, as long as we don't end up with a NASCAR template that the cars have to drive into, and they have
kind of gotten away from that. And in fact, NASCAR is starting to get away from that as well. Kevin, you might know more about this than I, but isn't NASCAR going to start enforcing that you have to have at least some passing nod to production body panels on the cars?
The new NASCARs for 2013 look way more like a production car than they do this template crap that's been floating around over the past few years.
Good.
I mean, you look at a Dodge Charger and it looks like a Dodge Charger. You look at a Chevy SS, it looks like a Chevy SS. You look at a Fusion, looks like a Fusion.
And that's not just stickers.
No, it's not just stickers. It's the actual bodywork of the car.
Okay, so it is proper production body panels.
Yes.
Of course, they're still silhouette cars.
Right.
As is any top saloon car, right? Whether it's DTM or GT1.
Yeah.
You know, they're all silhouette cars. But at least the car looks like what you could then go and buy in the showroom. And I've got to imagine that the manufacturers have to be really happy about that.
Yeah, and like I'm looking at some prototypes right now, some of the Daytona prototypes.
Well,
that's actually one great thing I always liked about the Daytona prototype series is you can look at a car going around the track and tell immediately what type of car it is.
Right, whether it's a Riley or a Dallara or whatever,
a Lola or right. Yeah.
And I really, really do like the 2012 Chevrolet, the Corvette styled.
The Corvette was awesome.
That looked sharp. It did. It really did. And so I will give Grand Am that they did allow variety, at least a little bit. There is some room for variation there. I know they're trying to contain costs, and we can have this argument all evening long about cost containment versus return on investment. The reason why manufacturers are in motorsports is to sell cars. And so if they can't demonstrate, if they're not allowed to demonstrate why their cars or their technology, their engines, their engineers are better than their competitors, then why bother? I mean, why don't we all just get in some DSPs in race SCCA, spec class, if we're going to do that.
And see, one of the thing I keep going back to personally is the AMLS and the ALMS product was a dying product. And it's not because it wasn't a good product. It was because it was too expensive of a product to run.
Well,
and that's why,
yes.
That's why I think that when they start coming up with the rules for the Univod series, what they need to do is they need to go grab the guys from Riley and the guys from Doran and the guys from Lola and the fab car people, and then go out and take Audi and Porsche and these other manufacturers, get them all in a room and say, okay, guys, here's what we need to do. We need to develop a top-level series that is worthy of being a top-level sports car series that also keeps in check.
Yes. You know, and then you're right there. You do have to, I'm sitting here, bashing cost containment. But you're right. You do have to keep the owners and the manufacturers from destroying themselves, right? It's what we saw with Honda and Toyota in Formula One. It's what we saw with CART in the early 90s, where they just spent insane amounts of money with no hope of gaining a return on that investment. So yes, I agree. There has to be a realistic cost, and yes, the cost of especially ALMS LMP1 competition was high, it was steep. It didn't help that the sports car landscape here in the U.S. is diluted and split.
Mm-hmm.
I think having the unified series will help with that, and I'm hoping that that we get over time some good intelligent regulation.
And I think they will. The two sides seem to be committed to making a decent product that has sustainability.
Yeah. And it's also got to have relevance,
Yeah.
I know that's so much the buzzword right now, but it is an important one. And again, I can't stress enough that motorsports has to get back to this race on Sunday, sell on Monday. If you're not selling on Monday, what's the point of being in motorsport?
Right. Agreed. Now, more sports car news. More along the lines of this unified series we're talking about for 2014, looks like they're considering racing some split series races in 2014, having the LMS series and the Daytona prototypes racing at separate venues.
Was this due to some event contract conflicts?
Well, it's a lot of it has to do with how many cars the facilities can hold, realistically. For example,
Lime Rock.
Yeah, Lime Rock is the biggest one. You had 26 ALMS cars, 29 Grand Am cars.
Oh, man. Can you imagine that? Oh, my God.
It wouldn't be crowded for long. Let's just say that.
No, it wouldn't be crowded for long as soon as everyone thought their name was Sebastian Grosjean and they decided to take out half the field.
Romain.
Romain. Did I say Sebastian?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, him too. Yeah, it's just... and I think that's going to be a good way to let people get use of their current equipment without everything becoming all muddied up. But then that also leads room for Danica Patrick to win the Grand Am or ALMS race with a diluted field.
Crap. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that.
She's not you know, I really wouldn't be surprised to see her move into sports car racing in the next few years.
This is after she gets kicked out of ARCA?
Oh, racing with Milka again.
Oh, God, that would be... Oh, what if you did this? What if you had a Grand Am team that was Milka and Danica and they had to share a car?
You know, and Mike, you'll appreciate this. I would pay real money to have an in-car camera and Mike with Milka and Danica in a rally.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Oh, man. Ouch.
One is a driver, one is a co-driver, maybe switching every other stage or something.
Oh, that would just be painful to watch.
Oh, I tell you what, that's proper entertainment right there. I'd pay hard coin.
God, that'd be amazing.
So anyway, moving on.
Moving on, there's potential talk of Daytona prototypes running at Le Mans as an exhibition class.
You know, I don't know how I feel about that. Because of what Le Mans has always meant in terms of innovation and especially what the exhibition class has meant in terms of innovation and new ideas and such.
The Garage 36 program, isn't that what they call it?
56?
56, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what... And I was very happy that the Delta Wing project with Highcroft Racing got invited last year before they got taken out. but anyway, I don't know that the DPs really fit that profile. I mean, yes, it's different from what we've seen at Circuit de la Sarthe before, but that doesn't mean that it's innovative, right?
I'm totally with Doug on this one. Yeah, you need to have the innovation there. That is what Le Mans is all about.
And I don't know. Maybe if in 2014, as you develop the relationship between the existing DP car and the LMP2 cars, maybe you create a DP car that is more directly competitive with LMP2, then okay. You know, say, hey, we can bring a tube frame chassis with a production stock block engine, direct injected, turbocharged, or whatever, and compete with the big guys in the monocoques. If you want to go that route, fine. But right now, in 2013, I don't know that it works properly. I think it's more politics than it is proper motorsport.
Well, and why would they even pay the money to go over there? What would be the benefit?
Just,
you know what I mean?
Just circulate around, De La Sarthe. That's it.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, it's also another interesting thing, though, is like it was brought up in an article on Speed, and that's the fact that in the past for like an exhibition class, they've even had NASCAR at Le Mans.
Yeah, that's true. And again, that was politic, right?
Yeah.
And that's exactly what this would be. And, you know, if it happens, it happens. You know, you cannot separate politics and motorsport. But it doesn't mean I have to like it or be happy with it.
And I guess there's two different ways you can view Le Mans. It can either be a spectacle of auto racing or it can be a spectacle of technology.
I think it's a little bit of both.
And see, I think that's where the DPs would fit in there, is under spectacle of racing, not necessarily technology.
But, well, and as Mike was kind of hinting at earlier, who would they be racing with?
Or right. With whom? Just amongst themselves, really.
Let me use the proper Queen's English here. You know, that's why I say if they were properly competitive with LMP2s, then I can see it. And it's because, just like what you said, Kevin, there'd be a racing competition to be had there. It'd be some good action to watch. They're just themselves sitting there just shy of the LMP2s and just ahead of the GT1s. I guess, know that it benefits them.
I guess my argument to that would be, why bother bringing a LMP2 when you know you're not going to be able to compete with the LMP1s?
Because they have... Well, all right. Fair enough. You know, they have a specific class for LMP2, but LMP2 has traditionally been a standard class. You have two prototype classes, you have two GT classes. but, I don't know, and sure, you can say, why, this is just a third prototype class, LMP3, I guess.
then you're just kind of diluting it.
Well, but the exhibition class, historically, has always been for things that were different.
Yeah, and like that's where I'm going to say hats off to the Delta Wing. I mean, nobody knew where it was going to slot in, right? Because it was just so innovative and so so oddball. I mean, you wouldn't have to do with the LMP2 like everybody else.
Right.
But this is where I get hung up with the DPs at Le Mans. And I know, yes. I have hated on Grand Am before, and I've hated on the Turtles that are the DPs before. And we'll continue to do so. But, you know, I've said my piece. I don't think they fit into the exhibition class. If you want to make a specific class separate for them, separate from the exhibition of new technology class, fine. You want to say, hey, we're inviting these guys over as a gesture of good faith for our future partners, fine. But not as the exhibition class.
And I have to agree with that. Even though I'm, like I said, the resident Grand Am fan, I don't believe that they belong at Le Mans as the exhibition class. I do believe that that should be reserved for projects like Delta Wing and their technical innovation, I guess is what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And even Grand Am is starting their own project like that with the GX series. So I think they would appreciate that too. And I don't think Le Mans is the correct place to be taking that series at this point in time.
You know, like I said, it's a political maneuver. And if they're just straight up with that to say what it is, fine. I'm happy.
One more sports car issue here. Audi confirms that they will run the R18 e-tron in WEC and at Sebring in 2013.
Cool. You know, I'm happy to see Audi continue to come back to the United States. I was fortunate enough to be able to see them in their last full season in the America Le Mans Series, 2008, when I went to the Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course, and I've missed them here ever since. You know, I've always thought that Audi and Peugeot, at least at Sebring and Petit, were really special things. But oh well, it's at least good to know that they're going to be at 2013. And these e-tron cars,
they're amazing.
I am super stoked about these. This is exactly what we've been talking about for the last half hour, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, definitely. This is innovation at the highest level. And what I like, from an engineering standpoint, being the engineer geek that I am, what I like is that the hybrid prototypes that they're running aren't the battery type, not the electric regeneration. Or power storage, they are flywheel. They're the flybrids, which I think is far more green than a big bank of batteries. Anyone who knows me has probably heard my rant on batteries. They're amongst the nastiest, the dirtiest, the ugliest things that we can possibly manufacture or recycle. I mean, even the recycling process of batteries is nasty, nasty business. And so if you want to be green, hey, these flywheels for power storage, this is a great idea. And these are Quattros? Are these all-wheel drive as well?
Yeah, Quattros in the name, they'd have to be.
That's what I'm thinking. You know, I'm sitting here looking at
the... You know what? That could be just the flywheel generation, though. That might be just when it comes off the flywheel.
Okay.
Yeah, Audi says it will enter three R18 e-tron Quattros in the 24 hours of Le Mans.
That's awesome, man. I have always been a fan of Audi. I've always liked what Audi has done and how they've continued to innovate and develop their prototype sports car program. And this is just them taking it to the next level. Go Audi.
Says that Audi has chosen Alan McNish, Tom Christensen to be at the R18 e-tron Quattro, and they've also selected Oliver Jarvis, or Olivier Jarvis, Lyric Duvall, Mark Green, and Luca Degrassi to round out the lineup.
Oh, Degrassi. McNish and Christensen are their standard drivers, and they are nigh unstoppable. They are great, great cars. You know, it's a shame that we're not going to see Bernard and Dumas in the cars next year. They were, of course, Bernard and Dumas are Porsche drivers, but Porsche, Audi, VW, they're all kind of under the same large roof and would often swap rides when, you know, for large events. But, oh well, it is what it is.
One quick thing to hit on before we move on here were results from Roar Before the 24. In the DP class, on the top of the speed chart, you had the Michael Valiente, Chris Cumming, Jorge Goncalves, and Gustavo Yacaman.
Woo!
In the number six, Michael Schenck, Ford Riley. In second, you had Dane Cameron, Wayne Nonnemaker, Simon Pagenaud, and Bruno Junqueira. In the 42, Solins, BMW Riley. Third, you had John Pugh, A.J. Allmendinger, Justin Wilson, and Marcos Ambrose. In the 60, Schenck, Ford Riley. In GT, you had Patrick Lindsay, Patrick Long, Jason Hart, Spencer Pumpley, and Jason Grafe in the 73 park place, Porsche GT3. You had Nick Tandy, Michael Christensen, Christian Engelhart, and Lance Wilesley in the 32 Conrad Motorsports Panama Porsche GT3. And rounding that one out, you had John Potter, Andy Lally, Richard Lietz, and Nicholas Armindo in the 44 Magnus Porsche GT3. In Grand Sport, you had Scott Maxwell and Jay Buford in the 55 Aston Martin. John Ferrano and David Impringham, there's a blast from the past, in the number 15 Aston Martin, and Stefan Muke in the number 7 Aston Martin. Street Tuner, you had Andrew Jordan and James Colburn in the 77 HPD Honda Civic SI. Kyle Gimple, Rich Eversley in the 75 HPD Civic SI. And Terry Borscheller and Max Lamara in the 23 BMW 128i to round out the times. Now,
well, you know, I want you to go back to that the very top of the list. Read off those names one by one for me, please.
Michael Valiente.
Okay. He's a DP driver, right? Through and through.
Yes. Yes.
Next name?
Chris Cumming.
Again, a DP driver, right?
Yes.
Those are the two mains in that car.
Yes.
Followed by
Jorge Goncalves.
Indy Lights represent.
Yep, yep.
Nice.
Gustavo Yacaman.
Indy Lights represent.
Nice.
So, you know, we know that there's a lot of IndyCar drivers that are racing in the Daytona 24, right?
Yes.
But what is often overlooked, there's also a lot of young open-wheel drivers racing as well, including a lot of Indy Lights drivers. And, you know, Jorge Goncalves has not had the best past couple of seasons with Velarde. He's done fair to middling, but you know, he's not really impressed a lot of eyeballs. And to see his car, you know, they're topping the time charts in at the Roar Before the 24 is great to see. And if I remembered you reading correctly, I think I heard several other open wheel names.
Name?
Yeah, I thought I heard several other open wheel names there in second and third. Did I not?
Yes, in second you heard Simon Pagenaud and Bruno Junqueira.
Nice.
And in third you heard A.J. Allmendinger and Justin Wilson.
Well, you know, I'm going to pass on Dinger being an open wheel guy.
Yeah,
he was several years ago in Atlantics. He did great in Atlantics, but. Man, that's a pass. He's a 10-topper now.
Yep. Yep, he is. I keep hoping that he would see the error of his ways and come back, but I just don't think it's going to happen.
Not going to happen. So,
the one that shocked me was hearing David Impringham name again. It's funny because everybody thought that he was going to be the next big Canadian driver instead of Greg Moore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But if I also remember correctly, isn't Impringham the guy that Jacques Villeneuve absolutely schooled in Atlantix? But no, that was Claude Bourbonnais. I'm sorry. That was Claude Bourbonnais.
Yeah. I must admit, that's before the time I was paying attention to Atlantix.
Yeah, Claude Bourbonnais and Jacques Villeneuve were both in the players program back in Atlantix. And Villeneuve won out. Everybody thought that Bourbonnais was going to be the machismo, but it turned out to be Villeneuve.
Well, and he backed it up at, what was it, 95, wasn't it?
Yeah, 95, won Indy and won the championship.
Yeah.
And then a couple of years later would win the F1 championship.
I was say, then he's the one that actually went over to F1, right.
And then fade
and black. It looked like a joke, right.
Well, and then he said, I don't need a good team. I can take a bad team and be awesome. And the answer is no, you can't.
Yep. Wrong answer. Not in Formula 1.
I'm going to go to bar.
You are not all that.
No, sir, you're not.
So, right. speaking of Formula One, the grid is pretty much settled, isn't it?
Well, except for two seats, one at Force India vacated by Mr. Hulkenberg, and the other in at Caterham, or Caterham, or however you want to say it.
Cat
Caterham.
Ate the ham.
Cathead biscuits.
Yeah.
Somewhere. I'm sure they'll find some ride buyer to fill both of those spots, actually. Maybe not necessarily as much on the Force India side. I mean, I would love to see someone like a Kovalainen or somebody like that take that Force India seat.
It depends on how all the litigation pans out, doesn't it?
What litigation are you speaking of?
Wasn't there? I'm trying to remember their team principal. But wasn't he under a lot of heat? In Mr. Weitz will be able to fill us in on this.
Vijay Mallya?
A lot of heat with Kingfisher and some funny money business.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, there was. Let's see, Vijay Mallya,
that's who it is.
There's been some sort of issue with Kingfisher. I can't remember off the top of my head what it is.
I remember there is some funny money business. And so I think it all depends on how well set his motorsports program is, considering his other the other things that are hanging over his head. Whether that ride is a paid position versus a ride buyer. But yeah, the Caterham position. Yeah, it's have car. Do you have money?
Yeah. Okay. What it is all right. Vijay Mallya is a liquor tycoon, so to speak, and he started Kingfisher Airlines, and it looks like he's starting to strike a deal with, how do you say it, Etihad Airways, E-T-I-H-A-D? It's out of Abu Dhabi.
Yeah,
but go
ahead.
Yeah, so they're trying to strike a deal to buy a share in Kingfisher. And Kingfisher currently has around $2 billion in debt.
Yeah.
So Vijay is trying to strike a deal to sell that and basically keep his Formula One team afloat and stake his and reaffirm his status as one of India's richest men.
Well, Mr. Shaw, I think you will attest to the fact that Abu Dhabi has serious, serious money.
Yeah, it's in deep pockets over there. Yeah,
Qatar. That is a rich, rich area.
Yeah.
Our very own Mr. Peachin is over in that area. It's stationed in Qatar.
I believe
Qatar
he's
right
in
now.
Qatar, actually.
Yeah, I'm hoping that he can find some benefactors and secure some funding for Open Paddock in 2013 and beyond. We'll cross our fingers.
Yeah, they just got money flowing out of their pockets, willing to invest in anything. So yeah,
oh, right. They wash the streets with money. So
that's right. Is illegal.
Yeah, but
it's illegal in that country.
But anyway, so yeah, Force India. It'll be interesting to see who they select, whether it's a ride buyer or a paid drive. I'm hoping it's a paid drive. I mean, they're a solid mid pack team. I'd hate to see them sink to what Williams has sunk to. And, you know, seeing Williams do that, it really breaks my heart. Not that I've always been a diehard Williams fan or anything like that, but, I mean, how can you not like Williams, right?
Yeah, I was a diehard Williams fan for a long time, simply because they had my favorite drivers. I mean,
yeah,
you had Nigel Mansell and Jacques Villeneuve. And those were two of my favorite drivers. Lots of similarities between the two of them. Oh, and Damon Hill. Gotta love Damon Hill. But you know what really killed Williams was when they went to that Mechachrome engine. Remember that?
Yeah.
And then the whole Cosworth debacle as well.
Oh. You know, Cosworth used to be such a great, great engine manufacturer. And I'm sure they still are, but they just stepped up. Well, let me use nicer language. They fouled up.
Cosworth is like the Suzuki of racing engines now.
Yeah, they kind of are, aren't they? They kind of are. But anyway, so more wackiness with Mr. Eccleston.
Tis the season to litigate. Fa la 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 la. Bernie says he wasn't colluding. Fa la 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 la.
When wasn't he colluding?
Bernie colludes everything, okay?
I know, right?
I mean, Bernie is a walking collusion. And if you don't believe that he's getting kickbacks for placing races in certain places, then, by God, I have a sun lamp I'd like to sell you in the middle of the Sahara.
Yep. I mean,
this guy has got his fingers stuck in absolutely everywhere he can. And you know what? It reminds me a lot of... I shouldn't talk about that. But, yeah, I mean, it's like certain CEOs will say, you know, I wasn't involved in the fraud. I never said fraud. Well, no, they never said fraud because they're smart enough then to use that word.
Right.
This guy's...
I think it's just, I wonder if it's just kind of the age thing. You know, back in the day, that was just business, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's how it was. You know, you made a deal on the side. It's like, you know, yeah, you benefit me, I benefit you. That's how things got done. World doesn't work that way anymore,
back,
Bernie.
I scratch your back.
Right. World's changed a little bit.
Yeah, especially in this world where you have fraudulent Grand Prix and teams that are promised engines that don't get them, and I don't know. Yeah, it's a bunch of craziness. Bernie says he's not guilty. He may not be guilty, but he's probably going to get forced out over the situation anyway.
That would be interesting.
Then what would his daughters do? Sauber and Ferrari and McLaren have passed their crash tests, gentlemen.
Well, that's not surprising. The more important test won't be the mainstays. Won't be Ferrari, McLaren, Sauber. There's two ends that will be interesting to see if they pass the first time around. One is people scraping for money. Caterham, Marussia, right? The other is the people who are pushing the absolute limit of the rule book, Red Bull. And so the fact that Ferrari, McLaren, Sauber have passed, I'm not surprised by that. Nor will I be surprised when Force India and Williams and Mercedes pass. What will be interesting is see what Adrian Newey comes up with and whether it passes its first go around.
Now, I can only remember one team actually failing their crash test, and oh my God, it was HRT. Failed at their initial year coming in.
Did anybody notice?
Well, I think Nalara said, well, we told you it wouldn't.
You know, when you don't
get paid your bill,
you know, when you don't test, the car don't work real good.
Yep.
Now we've also got car launches coming up. January 31st, the McLaren hits the streets, quickly followed on February 2nd by the Sauber, and a little interesting slip of the tongue here by Mr. Grosjean. End of January, Lotus plans to debut their car.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. I wonder what Renault and Gina Capital have to say about that.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, you know, Lotus hadn't been part of that team since spring of 2012.
Hey, well, Lotus makes some awesome decals, just so you know.
I was
going
to say, they'll be right there with their decals ready to put on the car.
Yeah, Gina Capital is like, piss off.
It's always a neat time of year when you start seeing the F1 car launches before the season and seeing the technology that people are going to be running for the upcoming year.
Well, it's what's really interesting is seeing the development between the launch and Melbourne.
They're not
always the same car. Right? There's a little bit of tweaking that goes on between launch time and race time. And as we've seen, there's a big difference between the cars at the beginning of the season and at the end of the season.
Yeah, it's always interesting to see the changes that come in the car between Australia and Malaysia.
Yeah.
Just that first one. And let's see, Ferrari splitting design effort for 2013 and 2014 to effectively fight for 2013 championship while designing 2014 car. Is this unusual information that a team would be designing their next car that early? I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't know. Ferrari, here's the thing with Ferrari. Ferrari is completely in the hands of the Italians now, right?
Right.
And when they had Stepney, when they had with Mercedes now, I can see him. Ross Braun. That's when they were, top level, unbeatable winning teams, right?
Oh yeah,
and,
sure.
And so now seeing them splitting their design effort between 2013, 2014. I don't know. I'm not keen on that. I think right now you need to be fully dedicated to your 2013 machine. As the year progresses, you, in a graduated way, shift your development efforts from your current machine to your future machine. But aren't the rules changing dramatically in 2014? Isn't that when the new engines were coming out?
Yeah, they're moving to a V6, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, they're moving to the global crap.
Yeah,
the
World Racing Engine.
Yeah, that one.
Or whatever it is they're calling it. That
yeah, it's like the global spec or something like that.
Right.
Or,
nobody else is using.
Yeah. That they want everybody to use for some unknown reason.
But it's not a bad idea. On first thought, your first thought is, it's not a bad idea. I mean, you think about what Mazda has done with their Renesis engine. With their MRZ engine, it's a production engine, it could be a race engine, applicable to a wide variety of series. Those are all lower element series, right?
Right.
When you get up to the upper echelons of racing, when you're talking about DTM, V8 supercar, GT1, or even GT2, IndyCar or Formula One, the engine requirements are so specialized. You can't have a global racing engine.
Mm-mm.
It just won't work. But anyway, Ferrari splitting their design effort, if they really are doing that, and they're not just saying that and doing what they should be doing, focusing most of their effort on 2013... Alonso's got a long row to hoe.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if he's gonna eventually want an out because they're not paying enough attention to give him a top quality car to contend every week.
And it's testament to Alonso's skill that they took what was essentially a freaking Lego car, right? We all made fun of this dog of a car at the beginning of the season.
Doesn't it have some sort of weird change in the suspension versus everybody else, too?
It did. And yet still, as doggy as that car was, especially at the beginning of the year, he made it into a championship contender. If you imagine Alonso back at McLaren, or Alonso at Red Bull. Can you imagine an Alonso at Red Bull?
Sure.
be unstoppable.
That would be,
you know, I'm a big Vettel fan. I really am. I think he's supremely talented. I think he's one of the best racers coming along in a long while. But when, you know, if Alonso were in that Red Bull car, you'd be watching Grand Prix merely to find out who came in second.
You know, I'll say this, and to equate it to terms that people that may not follow Formula One will get, but Fernando Alonso is the Tony Stewart of Formula One.
Yes, he is.
That dude can just flat out wheel a car.
Yes, he can make a car perform beyond what anybody else on the planet would be capable of extracting. You know, you always hear the term he's able to get 110% out of the car. He's able to push the car beyond its limits. No, if it's beyond its limits, he's in the wall, period, right?
Right.
He's able to extract the maximum out of a car. He's able to extract more potential out of a car than any other driver on the planet. He can take a car that most drivers would have a hard time finishing mid-pack and make it into a championship contender.
I guess what you could say about Alonso. I guess what you could say about Alonso is he expands the capability of the car.
Yes, yes, yes.
I'm in total agreement with you guys. I have a feeling that Sean would fire you right now.
You know, no, Sean. Sean's not a big Alonso fan, but he respects the talent. He respects the talent, and he is a huge Ferrari fan. Make no mistake.
That's true.
He is a giant Ferrari fan, so he would fire me for dogging on Ferrari and the Italians. But
we all know that Sean has a giant Felipe Massa poster hanging up in his bedroom.
Now I like Felipe.
It's been fun being on Open Paddock Podcast. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah, Felipe is my wife and I, Tabitha and I, is one of our favorite drivers to watch. We always root for Felipe. In spite of his being a Ferrari driver. We love Felipe.
He just tries so hard.
And I was so heartbroken when he had the championship for, what was it, 30 seconds?
It was like 14 seconds or something.
Yeah, I was like, oh. And to see his dad as he heard the news, oh, that was so heartbreaking. So heartbreaking. But anyway. Moving on. Do you have any other Formula One news?
I don't have any further Formula One news, good sir.
Well, kind of a transition from Formula One into Mazda Road to Indy. We spoke with Connor Daly last month before the end of the year, and he was that was right before his test with AJ Foyt, which went terrific, from what we heard. And you know, he mentioned he'd hoped to get a Formula Renault 3.5 ride for 2013, but he really just didn't have the money. But Kevin, looks like he found the money.
Yes, it does. And I gotta tell you, the World Series by Renault, or the Formula Renault 3.5, whatever you want to call it, either one of those names is a perfect name for exactly where Mr. Daly is gonna be, because I don't think he's quite ready to make that jump. Since we're talking Formula One right now, I don't think he's quite ready to make that jump from GP3 to GP2 just yet. But the Formula Renault 3.5 / World Series by Renault, whatever you want to call it, that is the perfect training ground that is really going to be able to tell Connor if he's going to be able to cut it at the next level or not.
Yeah. I agree with you. You know, we talked about this before the beginning of the show. The depth of competition in GP2 is so incredibly stiff. You know, we here in the States, very often we think Formula One, IndyCar, top of open wheel racing in our relative areas, right? And so the next step down, GP2, Indy Lights, are comparable, right? No, not at all. GP2 is incredibly competitive. And so the Formula Renault 3.5, I really think, is the right next step for Daly moving into, moving closer to Formula One. Even then, it's going to be tough for him to have a really good year. You know, that is a European racing is just so different and so much more competitive. So much more competitive than...
I swear, they're driving schools for everybody to get a license must include some racing classes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Have you seen the roundabouts in London? I mean, there you are,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, if you don't know how to do some serious driving skills there, yeah, you're going to end up running into a few people, for sure.
So what team is he going to be racing with in 2013?
Well, let's see. He said that he's had a few options, but he is not naming specific names just yet.
Okay, so he has the money, but he doesn't have a deal yet. Is that it?
I don't even know if he would say he fully has the money either. But he says that it's nearly in place, and he's got a budget for a competitive team, and that costs roughly $1 million.
Mm. Yeah, that's steep. That is steep.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here's hoping that he's racing with a top team. You know, someone like a Tech One or something.
Maybe a Carlin.
You know, he's had a relationship with Carlin in the past, hasn't he?
Yeah, he raced his first season of GB3. He was with Carlin.
Yeah.
But the funny thing about Carlin is they are one of the top teams in all of the Formula One feeder series except for GP3, which they thoroughly suck at.
Well, and they're kind of middling in Renault 3.5 as well. I mean,
they have a better World Series by Renault program than they do GP3. I'll tell you that right now.
Now,
of course, that's not saying much. But
yeah, I was going to say, out of their two drivers, they only got one win last year. In fact, as I'm looking at the results, they only got two podiums.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so anyway, for this expenditure to work, you've got to be with a top team. You can't get, what the hell? I just looked at this and there's a Lotus Racing team in
Slotus.
Yeah. Where did they finish in the championship? I gotta see this. I'm sorry for the aside here. Okay, they finished one spot behind Carl. Six. But anyway, you know, if you're going to move up, and this is something that we've seen even here in the States with the Mazda Road to Indy, if you're going to move up, you have got to be with a good team where you can show good results. If you're with a Midland team or a backmarker team, you know, chances are you're not going to get the call up to the next series.
Mm-mm.
You know, the best you can hope for is to either talk, connive, or pay your way into a ride in the same series with a better team and move up in that fashion. You know, you don't necessarily have to win the financial, or you don't have to win the championship. You know, you've got to show well enough that maybe you can bring some of the financials to supplement your on-track performance to bring you up. And so, you know, if he comes in with a Midland team in Renault 3.5, I worry about him getting stuck.
Be really interesting if he could get a ride with Arden Caterham and be teammates with Alexander Rossi.
That would be awesome.
Oh, is he racing? Is Alexander racing for Caterham?
He races for Caterham in the 3.5s. Yeah.
Is he doing so next year as well?
Yep.
Cool. That would be cool. And, you know, Alexander Rossi is really our has long been seen as our next best hope for Formula One, right?
Yeah, and he. You know, he started in actually GP2 Asia.
Right.
And had pretty good success in GP2 Asia, and then
Let's be clear, GP2 Asia is nowhere near the same as proper GP2.
No, what I was going to say is that put him linked to the now defunct USF1 team.
Oh, yes, that's right.
That was going to come around. He was going to be their test driver.
Yeah, he did nothing but make toast.
Yeah, and when that fell through, he went to GP3 and signed on with ART.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. He got two wins in his only year in GP3 and then moved up to 3.5s.
Yeah. And
he's had...
he did all right in GP3. Or, I'm sorry, in Renault 3.5. He had he was in the top third.
Yeah, he finished third in series overall in 2011, and he's got three wins in the series. So
yeah, so but anyway, so best of luck to Connor, whichever he decides.
Yeah.
However it works, but you know, if he does go to Renault 3.5, man, I hope he gets a proper team. He doesn't just get stuck in the middle of the pack. Clicking off laps with the rest of the chumps.
Well, speaking of European racing, I'm going to segue now into rally, because the season's already started. They don't really take much of a break when it comes to rally racing. They love the different conditions, of course. And, of course, this being the wintertime, the new European Rally Championship, or should I say the rebadged European Rally Championship, had its first event at the Jahner Rally, which is basically just means January Rally. It's in Austria, and kind of similar to Monte Carlo, which is just a couple weeks away. You've got a combination of tarmac with snow and ice, and talk about an amazing race.
Now they're properly allowed the use of studs, right?
They are properly allowed to use the studs. Actually, this is what's so interesting, is because it is such a gamble with the tire choice. In this specific case, it started out with roads that were just kind of wet, and then as they climbed in altitude, they became icy and slick and snow covered.
Yeah.
And so not only do they have a choice of studs or studless, but they can also use a wider tire, but there's limited on the number of studs. So studs are spread out more on the wider tire, but that might help you out a little bit on just the wet stuff, even though you still don't grip that well with studs. But the narrows with the studs all next to each other, they bite real good in the snow.
You know, and speaking of studs, quick aside.
Yeah.
I was thinking of the future Rallycross competition coming up here for the Kansas City region SCCA. I saw that Hankook make some wide studded snow tires for my Focus.
Oh, that might be fun.
No kidding. No kidding. Like, ooh, I wonder if I could use those. I'm going to look at the regulations.
According to most of the rally drivers out there, anyways, the studded tires on the ice and snow, it's better grip than you get on gravel. It is more like driving on tarmac.
Well, I was wondering what it would be like on a hard packed pasture.
Right. Of course, these are specifically designed tungsten studs and whatnot, obviously, on the rally tire.
Right.
But it is amazing the amount of grip they can get. But you put them on just straight asphalt, and they're slipping and sliding all over the place.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And, yeah, so, I mean, they're definitely...
Not to mention that the Department of Transportation is going to be displeased with you.
Yes, very much. Can you imagine what tungsten studs would do to the roads that... the cheap aluminum studs that we have
already.
Wow. That'd be like somebody taking a skill saw to the street, you know?
Right.
But, you know, in Europe, you know, that's allowed, at least for the race event. And just to give a quick thing about the European Rally Championship, if you remember last year, and actually for the past, 5 years running, there was the Intercontinental Rally Challenge. Mm-hmm. That is now defunct. They rolled that into what was a European Rally Championship before. They rebadged it. It's now out with in similar classes. You have the Super 2000s, which are normally aspirated 2-liter engines, little cars like Skoda Fabias, Peugeot 207s. And then you have the Group N type cars, but like the Group N R4s, which are a little bit lighter. They've done some work on those. So you got the Subarus and your Mitsubishi Evos out there. And then finally, they got a two-wheel drive class that, they kind of don't get much look at, and honestly, I didn't follow it.
Oh.
But what made
that's where you would see, like, the Fiesta R2s.
You're right. You'd see the Fiesta R2s, Citroen DS3, the ones that are not the four-wheel drive version, things like that, sure. The R2 class, stuff like that. But to kind of focus on this specific event, at the Jahner Rally, they... It started out right away, so wet conditions were on the first stage,
Second stage, it got more slick and snowy, and the third stage, just all ice. And there was three top guys going for it. A French guy in a Peugeot 207 named Brian Bouffier. You have the Czech driver for Skoda, who's their factory-backed driver, but he's only factory-backed for this one event. He has actually no money for the rest of the season. And he's in a Skoda Fabia S2000. And then you had another Skoda Fabia S2000 with a Red Bull backing for the local guy for Austria, from the Austrian Rally Champions. They have their own, you know, national championship. The guy's name's Boomschlager. I don't remember his first name. But what was great is to see that right from the get-go, Brian Bouffier and Jan Kopecky, they both went for the wide tires with the studs. Meanwhile, Boomschlager, you know, with his experience in Austria, goes for the narrows. First out of the gate, over a minute back is this Boomschlager guy, right? By the end of stage three, he's in the lead. So you have this huge battle going back and forth, these guys, but they're only seconds apart. What was made even more exciting is it then switched all terrain after the service, and these guys start really battling it out. And here comes along, these guys are fighting so hard with each other, and Group N cars start winning stages. And so you have this battle going back and forth of between S2000 cars and even Group N cars being involved. I did a great little article kind of summarizing the whole event on our website out of Open Paddock there. I encourage you to read it, but the bottom line is what it came down to. It really was just kind of mostly down to these three guys with the Super 2000s in the end. But here you're talking about 2 days of racing, 248 competitive kilometers they're racing, 18 stages, and the winner by 0.5 seconds. That's less than a car length when you're talking circuit racing.
Wow. And over how many days of racing and how many kilometers?
It was 2 days, 18 stages, 248 kilometers.
Wow. And it comes down to half a second.
Half a second and a hell of a push.
On the slippery stuff.
On the slippery stuff. And it went from slippery stuff. The second day, the temperatures warmed up to about 5°C, so about 48 degrees or something like that.
About freezing.
And it just dumped rain. They had fog and rain just coming down in buckets.
How is the visibility? How did the drivers deal with the fog?
You know, that's where it really comes in to how well you can make pace notes with a co-driver. You know, that relationship between a driver and a co-driver is key in that spot to where you know, even if your visibility isn't that great, where you can really push. Because, you know, you know a corner's approaching, you can kind of see that much, but you don't know how sharp it is, right? And it's all about having those good pace notes to know that, you know, I know that I can take this wide and then, you know, it's going to be a corner that tightens and I can really get in, you know, and push the limit right there. Versus somebody else that's kind of go more gingerly around the corner, you know, that might not be as experienced. And, you know, hats off, and I might as well just say it, it's a great article to read it, but Jan Kopecky and his co-driver, they started kind of dominating the event, being about 15 seconds ahead of the rest of the field on day two, but then disaster. Their front left tire shreds on them. So they drop they were ahead by 15 seconds, they drop almost a minute, and there's only 5 stages left. They pushed it to the limit. And just enough pressure on Brian Bouffier was the one that assumed the lead at that point. And they just kept pushing and pushing. The very last stage was 25 kilometers. They had to make up 10.8 seconds in 25 kilometers. And the rain just was coming down like crazy. And it couldn't have been easy. And they didn't even know they won when they got to the end. It was really great to see, especially with Brian Bouffier, who had finished first, you know, he had gotten to the finish line first, and he just stopped and waited to see what would happen when Kopecky came along. And I must say, Rally's got some of the best sportsmanship, too. They both congratulate each other for a great, great event. And again, 0.5 seconds, one hell of a win. And that guy, Jan Kopecky, and his co-driver, they deserve to be given a nice big check to race some more events. I can't believe they only got money to do the one event. So anyway, that was the Jana Rally. Like I said, what a great season to start things off. And of that event, I think about 6 or 8 of the stages were won by Group N cars. which is great to see as well, to see them actually competitive with the S2000. So I think that whole R4 spec that they've been working on the last couple of years might actually be something that can challenge a little bit, even though they're bigger, heavier cars, on some of the more challenging circuits that aren't, you know, that where the weather can be a factor. I think those guys will be able to actually compete a little bit, which is good.
So tell us a little bit about Dakar, Mike.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So next up is the Dakar. For those of you who don't know what the Dakar is, this is the annual event every January down in South America. The Dakar is a...
Wait, but Dakar isn't in South America.
Ah, but it is now.
Dakar is a state of mind, Doug.
You know, it used to be a city in Egypt. And, yeah. It's still an epic rally. I really like the route that they've chosen across Central America. You know, across and then back, right?
It kind of loops around. It changes every year. But what it is, actually, it's in just South America. It's between Peru, Chile, and Argentina.
Yeah. But, the original rally was Paris to Dakar. And they had race across the Sahara, and it was epic, right?
Yeah.
So I still love the rally, but doggone it, if you're not going to Dakar, don't call it the Dakar Rally. Change the freaking name. That's all I'm going to say about it.
Yeah, I think they've just changed it to Dakar as a state of mind now. I don't know. but it is all about the most challenging conditions. And the longest run, they call it a rally raid. And the basics of it are you've got 2 weeks. Every day you're covering 150, 200 miles of racing, and then another 150, 200 miles of just driving on the road to get to the bivouac service area to spend the night. And there's four classes. You have motorcycles that actually do this. If you can imagine every day for 2 weeks. Riding on a motorcycle 150 miles over desert dunes. You have quads, you have the cars, which includes mostly buggies and pickup trucks, and then you have trucks, and the trucks are these giant, massive things. They're just comical looking. You ever seen, like, the military trucks the Russians use?
Yep.
And that's what these things are. These big, monstrous vehicles, and they're just kind of hilarious.
Those are the guys that I'm really impressed with.
Yeah.
It is brutal doing this on a motorcycle or a quad, because they have a class for quads as well. But to see these guys lumbering around these huge lorries, it's just amazing.
But you know what? I can see, and my wife was asking me, it's like, well, why do they race? I mean, it seems very ridiculous driving one of these big trucks on one of these things. But, you were talking earlier about the, drive on Sunday, win on Sunday, sell on Monday thing.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it's about.
In the world that don't have well-paved roads and things like that, what truck are you going to buy for your business that needs to make it from A to B?
Damn Skippy.
So I think if you're buying a truck that's got to deliver some critical cargo, you might want to buy the brand that won the Dakar.
and that's it exactly. Thanks to Eisenhower, we have a great luxury in this country in having a fantastic transportation infrastructure. As much as we may complain about our highways at times, no, we have no room to complain. Our highways are amongst the best in the world. Really, transportation in a lot of places is still dodgy business, and you've got to get over some serious terrain, and this is a great test and demonstration of these machines.
Yeah, they definitely the other thing that goes in with the Dakar is not only the distance that they go, because it's 5,000 miles. I mean, it is just crazy long.
But you do 5,000 miles here in the States, and you're on four-lane highway the whole time. You got rest areas and truck stops and all that.
What's funny is these guys have this scrolling pace notes thing that's just, you look at the description, and it's just very general. There might be, a mountain to your left somewhere and, something over here, but they don't really have very good directional stuff. they actually have a GPS, but it's not for navigation. The GPS is only activated when they're within a very close range to one of the waypoints, and they got to make sure they make it past, you know, at least enough of these certain waypoints along the way to where the finish is for the stage. But we're talking about big open areas that, you know, they basically say start, and you got to somehow get, you know, 150 miles from here where there's nothing to reference you on how to get there other than this little scrolling thing, you know, that's kind of moving along and showing you it just very loosely, you know, suddenly you have this 40-story dune in front of you. Do you go around it? Do you try and go over the top? And then once you get over there, are you going to lose kind of direction where you're going to go? You know, it's just amazing navigational challenge. And then the temperatures. We're talking about in the hot heat of the day, it was 98 degrees there yesterday out there in the desert. And so they've got some pretty harsh conditions. Then it gets to freezing temperatures at night, and you get guys that will get stuck out there trying to dig out their cars out of the dunes, you know, in the middle of the night, and, you know, maybe having to put up a little shelter, just kind of shelter them from the cold, and then try and dig it back out again in the morning. It's some crazy stuff. And just wanted to do a couple quick highlights of who's kind of in it. We've got from America, actually, you've got in the cars division, you've got Robbie Gordon, who had a tough season last year. He had teamed up with our friend who's with M-Sport now, Nasser Alatia. Well, the relationship between Nasser and Robbie Gordon wasn't so good last year. So Nasser
it was a little sketch.
Just a little sketch, yeah. Nasser was, of course, Robbie Gordon's got the Hummer team. He's driving those big Hummer cars that are, what, I guess owned by China now, right?
I think it, you know, is he still running the Corvette engine in there?
I think so, yeah.
And, yeah. You know, the thing that surprises me, and it just seems ludicrous to me, is that because of the motor he's running, he has to run that thing in two-wheel drive configuration?
Yes, it is just rear-wheel drive only.
That's insane, man.
I know.
You're trying to go across the, we think of the Sahara as the most brutal desert in the world, right? No.
Yeah,
It is the Atacama. The Atacama Desert in Chile is the most brutal desert you will ever see. And you're trying to go across that in a two-wheel drive monster truck? Really?
Yeah, it's definitely interesting.
Rear-wheel drive at that, you know? So I don't know about the wisdom of that. Although he's done well with it in past years. Not win, but he's been competitive. Although, how well is he doing this year?
Well, so he started out this year. It was really kind of frustrating because the very first stage they did was only like 30 or 40 Ks. And what they did to make it compensate to be equal to the later stages that are much longer is anything that happened on the short stage, they just triple it. And so what happened was Robbie Gordon was coming up this big dune, and he got a little stuck. Well, he goes to put it into reverse, and the gearbox locks up.
Oh.
And frustratingly, he finally gets free 10 minutes later and gets going on down, you know, and gets his way to the end, but he's 10 minutes back on the leaders. Well, that automatically turns to 30 minutes of deficit because everything is tripled, including how far back you were.
Right.
So he was pretty upset about that. And understandably so. The next day, so we're on day five now, I believe. So stage two, there was problems with the GPS navigation system that everybody was in and following, and ended up doing not so well. He was another 10 minutes back, but it wasn't too bad. And then on stage three, he really came back. He finished second. He started really cooking it on that one. And then finally, on today, he ended up rolling it on his roof.
Oh. Whoops. So, put a fork on him, he's done.
Yeah, I think he's done. I mean, granted, it's a long ways to go. I mean, this is only day four or five of, you know, 12 days of the event. So, I think he's still got an ability to claw back to get a top 10 position easily. I mean, he made it back to 13th from being 47th, I think it was, which was how much he made up over other guys that had issues. But it's going to be—he's never going to be able to top Nasser Alatia, Carlos Sainz, two-time World Rally Champion, by the way, Stefan Petterhansel, who's won the Dakar like 10 times, did it like 6 times on motorbike and 4 times in cars. So, yeah, to beat those guys, it's not, probably not going to happen. But, yeah, so anyways, if you guys are interested in just keeping track of what's going on, it is really interesting to follow some of this crazy stuff. They got these little highlights that you can watch. It's just 30 minutes on speed. They got it on at night. Where I am in the Pacific zone, it's at 11:30 at night, from 11:30 to midnight, I think, or 11 to 11:30. They do a little 30-minute highlight thing. So set your DVR and just take a little watch of it. It's just amazing to see these vehicles drive out in these conditions. It's just crazy cool. So anyways, I'm going to roll on away from the Dakar. And like I said, it is an amazing event. I can't wait to see who comes out on top in the end. But it won't be an American, I'll tell you that. But speaking of American, we do have a little bit of news about Rally America. So their season will be kicking off with the Snowdrift Rally, which will be at the end of this month.
That's coming up real soon.
Yeah. So just a couple weeks away, getting excited. That is the one where they're not allowed studded tires. So
right.
That will be
a little dicey. It can get interesting up there with without studs.
It can, especially the second run through the stages. So if they get good just packed snow, there's usually pretty good grip, especially with modern studless tires, which I think that's a great way to kind of for them to test some of those new tires out there these days.
Wow, but when you have ice, like a couple years ago, we had just glare ice.
That was last year. Last year was nothing but straight glare ice. I mean, you couldn't go more than 5 miles an hour around a corner at some point without sliding off into a tree.
Yeah.
It was pretty crazy. But in the areas that, you know, and that's usually happens also from, like, the second run through, because I mean, they've got a number of people. I mean, one thing I love about Rally America is how grassroots it is. So you got a lot of local people that will be jumping in and racing the event. So what happens is you got these warm engines that go over the snow, turning it into glare ice, you know. So by the time 40 cars have passed, what was nice snow that everybody could grip on is now going to be glare ice. So it really makes it interesting for the second run through a stage. They'll have their pace notes that they're following from the first time run through, and then they go to run it the second time, and they're going to have to slow down.
Different. It's all
exactly.
different.
Exactly. Very
but
different.
There's, in addition, you know, we talked about how Rally America has expanded to 7 events for 2013, but there is a big change. One that Mr. Weitzel, I'm not sure, is going to be a real fan of.
Yes, that would be that they have now teamed up with USAC. So that's they kind of joined up with them for to allow both Rally America licenses and USAC memberships to receive benefits and inclusion into the Rally America events. So. I think a lot of this teaming up with USAC was probably to get contacts for sponsorship sharing and to get contacts into promotion for, you know, like maybe some sort of, press type of stuff.
And we know how well USAC does at promotion.
USAC is one letter away from what it is.
You suck. Yeah, well, as soon as I saw that, it's like, no, I don't want these chumps associated with my rally racing.
You know,
I've seen what they've done to sprint car racing.
Yeah, but, you know, having some contact, at least another racing series versus none, is probably better than nothing. I don't know.
I hope you're right.
To me, this just opens the door for global rallycross.
It might, and you know, I have enjoyed the crap out of all the Rally America events that I've been able to go to, that I've been able to follow online. Last year they had the live video with Matt Johnson doing some commentary, which was brilliant, by the way.
Oh, yeah, especially when they had a chance. You know, it was great to see the live stuff, but even better when they had a chance to go back and edit it. Really good videos.
You know, I enjoyed the live stuff. You know, a car would come by, and then on the fly, immediately, Johnson is sitting there analyzing his driving style. If they screwed up, he told you what they screwed up, why they screwed it up, how they should have done it different. It was amazing. It was great.
Yeah,
great stuff.
That kid's got eyes. I mean, what's amazing is he could tell when a car goes by. He's looking into through the windshield and seeing their hand position as they go through a corner.
Yep.
And he could tell you if they did it right or wrong.
Yep. And you know, so I think it's a great series with a lot of great things in place. And I just hope that USAC doesn't screw it up. I hope this is a positive thing.
Well, it's a one-year agreement, so it's only for 1 year, and I didn't, you know, it's not like a merger or anything like that, so...
Right.
It's just kind of a partnership to see if, I think both sides are trying to get some attention for each other.
Yeah.
So, we'll see what happens from there, but yeah, you know, good on them for trying, and, yeah, I hope that doesn't mean anything will happen to Matt Johnson and what they've been doing. I've been very happy with the coverage this last year that they did. Heck, I remember when it was Snowdrift last year, and they were first experimenting with it.
Yeah.
And they were using cell phones attached to a camera, you know, to try and do a data feed upload of live video.
Well, that's what they were doing at all the events, is you know, a cellular network type of patch-in.
Yep.
And I thought it worked pretty darn well, you know, especially you consider that a lot of these rallies, and especially a place like, were you able to follow any of the 100 Acre Wood Rally online last year?
Yeah, I definitely watched what stuff they could, because, you know, they'd get out into a place and they thought they'd have signal.
No, there's no signal out there, man. I mean, you know, you saw Deliverance, right? That's
yeah,
where this takes place, is there in the Ozarks, deep in the Ozarks. You know, so there's no cell towers, man. but anyway, so, you know, I saw that, and it makes me nervous. But, oh, well, let's hope for better things. So how's WRC doing?
WRC, well, they're gearing up for the first race of the year, which is going to be, you know, the Monte Carlo. And as we get ready for that, there's all the talk of the big new promoter. You know, we got Red Bull in there with, Sports Media House or whatever it is over there in Europe. And they finally just inked a deal here for who's going to be doing the producing the television part of it. And it's going to be Host Broadcasting Services, which is a Swiss company. So they're pretty well known, I guess, for sports and media. Not that I would have recognized them, but, you know, it is Switzerland. They're neutral, so maybe they just don't stand out.
Right. Everything is beige.
But, what's that?
So their logo is beige.
That's right. Exactly. Don't pay too close attention to us. Right. But, you know, similar to other things that they've done, they're already stating on the WRC site that they're going to be producing your typical 26-minute highlight show at the end of each day of an event, and then also do a full 52-minute, show of the that'll do on the final day. Hopefully that'll mean some live coverage or at least catching the entire power stage for those events that have a power stage. Those are always fun to watch to see the drivers really push at the end for those. So we'll have to see how that pans out. I was looking all over to see, you know, okay, well, are these going to be in the States? Are we going to be able to see anything? You know, I was over on Speed and NBC Sports Network and couldn't find anything. And honestly, literally tonight, just before our show started, I finally saw that there will be WRC TV. There will be a listing for these highlight shows through Speed. So Speed is going to carry it in the United States. Yes, thank goodness. And they did have it last year for part of the season.
Right.
You know, with the crazy lack of promotion that they had. But Speed is going to have it. And what else is I going to find out about that? They do have a website. It's going to be, you know, speedtv.com/WRC, but it looks like it's not fully done yet because you go there and you get kind of blocky stuff that doesn't load all the way and whatnot. So it's under construction, but I'm hoping to see some good content that they add there. To see them actually create a spot that slash WRC, that's actually unique for Speed.
They didn't have anything dedicated to WRC before, so maybe that's showing a hint of growth in the United States for coverage. Don't know, but be good to see. So I think that's pretty much it, though. So it's everybody just kind of waiting. You know, you got guys that have been out there testing for upcoming Monte Carlo. And like that Yonner Rally that I had done the article on, it's really always an exciting event. It, not only is it the oldest and longest running event of the WRC in rally history, but Monte Carlo has that same changing road conditions.
Maybe I should talk more about it next week. Right?
The most famous or infamous has got to be the Col de Turini. Basically, Col is a mountain. And the Col de Turini, you'll start out on cold, dry tarmac. As you climb the mountainside on the Col, it's all switchbacks going up. You move into ice and snow. All over the crest, you've got snow. And then you'll come back down, and you'll start drying up again. So what tire do you pick? You know, you pick the studded tire, then you're slow halfway up, but then you're good at the top, but then you're slow again on the back down, or do you chance it and go with, you know, tires that are more just, studless, more of a just a tarmac or a winter tire. You're quick on the dry stuff. You have to be careful up at the top, and then you're quick on the, you know, back down again. It is a real toss of the coin of what's going to be the best way to go. And it'll be exciting to see who chooses what and who dominates that event.
Well, we'll look forward to Monte Carlo, certainly, and, you know, especially here in the States, the snowdrift, and looking forward to your review, or preview, I should say, of snowdrift here coming up, right?
Oh, yeah. Right? Something coming up. Yeah, definitely. I can't wait to see. I haven't seen if Ken Block's going to be there, but we're definitely going to have David Higgins back with Subaru and, of course, Antoine Lestage.
Yeah, and Lestage is bringing some serious guns this time. I saw that he was he had his machine torn down in a rebuild for the beginning of the season. His new machine, the old WRC machine.
Well, that's not his new machine, and that is not a machine that he will. You weren't here, I think, when I was talking about that.
Okay, I remember when you said that he had purchased one of the old Mitsubishi WRC machines.
He did not purchase. He went and got to test it in the Czech Republic.
Oh, okay.
Team over there that maintains a 2005 WRC, so it's basically a car that's stripped all the way down and built from the ground up into WRC spec, which is so different from his production car that has been converted into a rally car. They don't strip it all the way down. They just kind of piecemeal it together. And so very different. I mean, it's so expensive. That's what his problem was. He got to test that other car over there this winter and was very impressed with it, would love to bring it over here. But he's got to get the money to do it. But if we could have Lestage in an 05 Mitsubishi WRC, Higgins in his Subaru Open Class,
right?
And at the same time, you'd have Ken Block in his his Ford Fiesta. I think that'd be an epic battle.
It would be.
So.
Don't
expect to see it, though, for the car from Lestage, at least probably not at the beginning of the season. If you see it, it might be at specific events, was kind of what he was hinting at. It's a lease deal. It's not something that he would just own. It's an expensive car to run where, you know, parts that you normally would replace just at the end of an event with his current car, you have to replace multiple times throughout the event on that car because they're just designed to fail.
Right.
That kind of stuff. So it's very expensive to run, and he wants to do it, but got to find the backing.
Well,
speaking of backing, Mazda Road to Indy. What do you have there for us, Doug?
Yeah, I was going to say, moving back to open-wheel racing, there's a bit of a Canadian invasion going on in the Mazda Road to Indy right now. Over the holiday weeks, you know, of course, we took a break during Christmas and New Year's. We went traveling to see friends and relations. Coming back, our email boxes were full. All kinds of driver signings. Babs Racing has signed three new drivers. Two of them were Canadian. Dalton Kellett Jesse, oh, jeez, French Canadian. So again, my French kind of is not so good. Jesse Lazare, Lazare, L-A-Z-A-R-E. So again, those of you who are more proficient with the French language can help me out.
We're gonna be Lazare.
Lazare, thank you, Jesse Lazare. And Jason Wolf, who's from Ohio, have all signed up. Dalton Kellett, by the way, and this makes me very happy. Dalton Kellett is a sophomore at what university? Where is it? Oh, I just had it in front of me. And of course now there it is, Queen's University, up there in Canada and in Ontario. He is studying engineering physics. I'm like, yes!
Oh, that's awesome.
I know,
that's
right?
Awesome.
Like, that's what I like to see. You know, more geeks in motorsports. Yes. You know, we actually have been seeing more and more of this. Christy Carson, who races Dirty Girls Racing, or Dirty Girls Rally, in the Rally America series. She's a meteorologist. We're seeing a lot more in all forms of motorsports. Drivers who are interested in the physics and the engineering of their sport. And so, very, very cool when I read that about Dalton Kellett. Driver that we've talked with before here on the show, Stefan Razzledazzle Radzinski, who first came to the IndyCar, the Maserati Indy program in the Firestone Indy Light Series up in Edmonton, has a full-time deal in USF 2000 with JD Motorsport. Stefan, up in Edmonton, wasn't his only time racing Indy Lights. He's raced one-off events here and there. But this will be his first full season deal in the Maserati Indy. So I'm happy to see him in and hope he progresses quickly. And lastly, Bilardi fills out their racing docket in USF 2000 with Canadian carter Daniel Burkett. Daniel has been a very, very successful carter up in Canada, finally racing the Rotax DD2s, the shifter carts with the front brakes. Very, very challenging carts to drive fast. And anyway, so he's joining Bilardi along with Matt McMurray. So be interesting to see how well they do. The USF 2000 series starts off here not too long, here pretty quick at the Sebring, the 12 hours Sebring, along with the American Le Mans series. In the Pro Mazda, Lloyd Reed has joined JDC Motorsport as well. So JDC is quickly filling up their ranks across their various platforms. Reed is, he's not technically he's a rookie, although this won't be his very first time in a Pro Mazda machine. He ran at the Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca last year, and it did decent. Had a decent outing, but this will be a full season deal with JDC Motorsport, and JDC always puts together great machinery. It seems to hire some quality drivers. We saw Gabby Chavez do very, very, very well last year, especially towards the end of the season in JDC machinery. So, anyway, so that's all I have for Star Mazda. For Pro Mazda, we are still waiting on the Pro Mazda schedule. That is taking forever to come out, and everybody's getting anxious to know just where the new Pro Mazda series will be running.
And as for IndyCar, it won't take but a second. Firestone Inc.'s long-term deal to be the tire supplier for the IndyCar series. That deal runs through 2018. No surprise. Do what?
That puts a kibosh on the whole Hoosier Continental Cooper rumors with IndyCar, doesn't it?
As far as it relates to the top series, the answer is yes.
I'm not terribly surprised.
Secondly, Judd interested in finding another engine partner after getting the drive shaft by Lotus.
You know, I said from the beginning that Judd is capable of producing a quality, top-notch, championship-winning engine. They've demonstrated it in the past. It's just Lotus's failure to fund the program properly that resulted in the pathetic performance that we saw last year. And so I really hope that that what happened last year, that people don't hold that against Judd. They really should hold it against Lotus and only Lotus.
It's not Judd's fault. It's Lotus's fault for not signing the checks.
Yep.
Lastly, here we've got Robbie Gordon's Stadium Super Truck Series. It's going to have some IndyCar tie-ins. For an example, they are going to be running as a support event for the 2013 Long Beach Grand Prix, and you will see big metal ramps for jumps on a street course.
So is this going to be like the Torque Series type of trucks, trophy trucks like that?
Yeah, it's sort of like trophy trucks, maybe a little bit more robust than the Torque Series.
This almost reminds me of the Iron Man series. Remember that back in the like late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah, Ivan Stewart's thing.
Ivan Stewart, yeah.
Yeah, it's more along those lines, and like the Mickey Thompson series, so right. to speak. And Panther Racing actually has purchased two of the trucks. So
sure, why not?
That'll be interesting for sure.
I wonder if that isn't partly because of their National Guard tie-in.
Yeah, you definitely have to think that was playing into it. I mean, what says America more than a truck jumping through Long Beach?
Yep.
I think that's going to wrap it up for episode 170 of the Open Paddock Podcast. Doug, do you have anything you'd like to add before we leave out?
Yes, I do.
Ooh.
If you would like one of these wonderful Mazda 2013 calendars, all you have to do is go to the website, openpaddock.net, find the article post for episode 170 of the openpaddock.net podcast, and leave a comment. So you'll leave your email address there as you leave your comment. Just comment on the podcast. That's all you have to do.
That's pretty tough, Doug.
I know, right? We'll take a random draw of all the people who have left a comment there on the website, and I'll draw from a hat, and we will contact the winner and ship to you this beautiful 2013 Mazda Speed Motorsports Racing Calendar with just some fantastic stuff from the whole gambit of Mazda racing, from the very top, the very pinnacle of what they do, all the way down to the grassroots SCCA solo racing. Every bit of it. It's gorgeous stuff.
Excellent. Mark, do you have anything you'd like to say before we head out?
Nothing really. Just, until next week. But I guess keep track of what's going on with the Dakar. It's pretty neat stuff if you've never seen that kind of racing before.
Yep. I guess my only thing is I will be watching the next round of AMA Supercross this coming weekend. So I can't remember where it is. It's probably somewhere in California if I were betting. But... That's all we got. Episode 170, Open Paddock Podcast. For Doug and Mike, I'd like to say thank you for listening, and we'll see y'all all again real soon.